Hello, and welcome to Subverse Casts, your source for interesting topics and news updates. Today's topics that we will be covering include information about the formation of the U.S. Space Force, the Chinese threaten Taiwan with war, the red tide sweeps across the ocean, Cuba is being accused of sonic attacks on the brains of U.S. embassy workers, and Ebola breaks out in the Congo. If you enjoy the content we make, then make sure you follow us on Minds at subverse.minds.com, where you can find our articles, exclusive content, and our distributed newsroom. But before we get into today's topics, we have updates about ongoing protests in Puerto Rico and Hong Kong, as well as the situation between South Korea and Russia. As protests in Hong Kong continue, China has made its most forceful warning yet, stating on Wednesday that it was prepared to deploy its military to the city if protesters threaten governmental authority. The protests, which are aimed to help Hong Kong retain its autonomy and the preservation of unique characteristics aside from China, started on March 31st. The protests started with the proposal of an extradition bill, which would subject citizens of Hong Kong to de facto court jurisdiction from the Communist Party of China. The Chinese government's threat of force is a stark reminder that Beijing still has control over the territory of 7.4 million. Colonel Wu Qian of China's Ministry of National Defense issued a warning to protesters, stating, "The behavior of some radical protesters challenges the central government's authority, touching on the bottom line principle of one country, two systems. That absolutely cannot be tolerated." Analysts state that the military intervention in Hong Kong will likely inflame the situation, exacerbating the exact reason of why people continue to protest. Elsa Kanya, an expert on Chinese military and defense strategy, said in an interview with the New York Times, "I think it is likely to backfire and further harden public opinion and concerns about the Communist Party of China at a time where the one country, two system model is being called into question." Puerto Rican Governor Ricardo Rosello is reportedly resigning from office amid 12-day-long protests calling for his resignation. The governor has been at the center of a message leaking scandal that has crippled his administration's ability to carry out its duties. Rosello stated previously that he would remain in office regardless of the public outcry and finish out his term, but that he would not seek re-election, saying, "My effort and my commitment is to follow through on some of the efforts that I've established for the people of Puerto Rico. That includes establishing, again, a plan that I've already circulated with members within the White House so that we can battle this corruption." In the United States, members from both parties have called for Rosello's resignation. Among those, Republican Senator Rick Scott, as well as Democratic presidential candidate Julian Castro. A government source close to the Rosello administration stated that the governor would be stepping down in a quick exit and that Rosello would be releasing a video to help move the island government forward. Reports that Russia apologized to the South Koreans over an alleged encroachment on South Korean airspace Tuesday is now being denied by Russia's embassy in Seoul. The joint air patrol between China and Russia was calls for the South to scramble fighter jets that shot off 340 rounds as a warning to the Russian A-50 surveillance aircraft. The statement, indicating that an undisclosed Russian military attaché had expressed regret over the actions, citing an equipment malfunction as the reason for the entry into South Korean airspace. The claims come from Seoul earlier today. Russian diplomats were quick to deny any regret, as well as this version of events. The Russian embassy released a statement stating, "The Russian side did not make an official apology. The embassy has begun noting inaccuracies in comments from the South Korean side."
On July 27th, the Trump administration's Space Force Framework Bill passed the Senate and is now awaiting House approval. About 2 weeks after Vice President Mike Pence gave a speech at Vandenberg Air Force Base saying, "We're working with members of Congress, and I'm proud to report legislation is already moving through the House and the Senate to establish United States Space Force, and soon it'll be a reality." The approval in the House has the future sixth branch of the U.S. military under a different name, the Space Corps. Like the Marine Corps, the Space Corps will be led by a four-star commandant who would be a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Space News quoted the Cooper-Rogers Amendment as saying, "The Space Corps will have personnel and assets transferred by the Air Force, but may not include the personnel or assets of the National Reconnaissance Office or the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency." The specifics of how the Space Force will be formed, staffed, and funded were negotiated in closed-door meetings on Capitol Hill at the Pentagon. According to Space News, the administration and the Senate are still at odds on multiple fronts. One key disagreement is over the basic organization. The administration is still pushing its original proposal to stand up the service as soon as Congress enacts it, and set it up to be the mold for other branches. The Department of Defense would create a Space Force headquarters in the Pentagon, led by a 4-star chief of staff, a 4-star vice chief of staff, and an undersecretary of the Air Force for space. The Senate Armed Services Committee doesn't want to hastily establish anything. Instead, it directed a 1-year transition during which the Space Force would be run by the commander of the U.S. Space Command General, John Raymond, who would be dual-hatted as commander of the Space Force and of U.S. Space Command. After the 1-year transition, the Department of Defense would submit to Congress a plan to give the Space Force its own commander, who would be a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. On July 13th, French President Emmanuel Macron approved of the creation of a space command within the French Air Force to improve the country's defenses. To give substance to this doctrine and ensure the development and reinforcement of our space capabilities, a space command will be created next September in the Air Force, Macron said, adding that it would later become the Space and Air Force. Reuters reported the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, aims to recognize space as a domain of warfare this year. The French military spending program for 2019 until 2025 has earmarked 3.6 billion euros for investments and renewal of French satellites. Award-winning think tank Chatham House published a research paper on July 1st identifying weaknesses of satellites during cyber warfare. According to The Hill, the report warns that policymakers need to grasp the full impact of these cyber vulnerabilities. The key will be shaping the approach to space security in the right way. In this regard, the Trump administration has given too much attention to so-called dominance in space and not much on how a space force would be configured. There is a better way, taking into account the importance of space to U.S. security and the best way to defend existing and future assets.
40 years ago, the U.S. Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act, meant to support the governing authorities of Taiwan. The act does not guarantee the U.S. will intervene if the People's Republic of China attacks or invades Taiwan, nor does it require them to intervene. Its purpose is to ensure the U.S.-Taiwan policy determines any decision to defend Taiwan will be made with the consent of Congress. The Chinese ministry claims the United States has, quote, provoked intensified competition among other major countries, significantly increased the defense expenditure, and undermined global strategic stability, end quote. Taiwan called on China to renounce its claims that they will use force against the island hours after the Chinese warned that they are ready for war if Taiwan moves towards independence. Taiwan's Mainland Affairs Council later said in a statement that Beijing's, quote, provocative behavior seriously violated the peace principle and international laws and relations, challenging regional safety and order. We urge Beijing authorities to renounce irrational, malicious acts such as the use of force, and to improve cross-strait relations and handle issues including Hong Kong rationally so that it can be a responsible regional member, end quote.
For years, there has been a scourge plaguing the coastline of the United States, specifically an algae bloom known as Karenia brevis, more commonly referred to as the red tide. The red tide has a large scope, going as far down as Florida and as far as Maine and British Columbia. While the vernacular red tide has been a common phrase used describing the algae that turns coastal waters a blood red color, there are misconceptions surrounding what the invasive flora does, as well as how it is harmful to the marine ecosystems that it cohabitates in. In the ocean, there is an innumerable amount of algae, microscopic to the naked eye. While algae is an essential component to ensuring that the ocean ecosystems stay alive, when algae is supplied excess nutrients through photosynthesis, they can multiply at an unprecedented rate. The excess helps the formation of large mass of algae that smothers nearby ocean life, the red tide. Algae is harmful to humans as well, creating a toxic byproduct as harmful algal blooms, or HABs. HABs are formed from the excess nutrients, such as nutrient-rich soil runoff from forest and grasslands downriver, fertilizers and excrements from livestock, or coastal erosion. Historically, red tide has been deadly, with larger sea animals succumbing from the ingestion and inhalation of toxic fumes. From 1987 to 1988, the red tide claimed the lives of more than 740 bottlenose dolphins, who died after ingesting contaminated fish. More recently, in 1996, it was recorded that the bloom killed 149 manatees that washed up on the Florida coastline. The red tide does not just create toxic seas, it also creates what's known as dead zones, a phenomenon where when the algae dies, the microbes that begin feeding on them consume much of the oxygen in the ocean. The result is that there is little oxygen left for fish and other creatures that breathe underwater, which leads to deaths en masse. President Trump addressed red tide as part of his environmental agenda, noting that the algae is a big problem, causing tremendous havoc. The president is focusing on coastal fisheries in the state of Florida, who have been affected by the algae blooms extensively. President Trump allocated $100 million towards stemming the issue. Most recently, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, said that this past month has been especially deadly, citing that 174 dolphins have been killed off in the past month alone. This most recent outbreak of red tide is said by experts to be tied directly to higher surface water temperatures and ocean acidification. Michael Crosby, CEO of the Moat Marine Laboratory and Aquarium, as well as former chief scientist for the NOAA, stated that funding for the project to stem the destructive effects of the red tide will most likely come in the form of funding the agency to save the coral reef. In an interview with the Washington Examiner, Crosby stated, "I have high confidence that the NOAA is going to take a significant level of ownership in not just studying, but helping to get the funds out the door to launch a whole new initiative that focuses on coral disease and response restorative initiatives. Coral reefs and ensuring that the coastal environment is kept intact brings approximately $3.4 billion in economic value to the United States, including tourism, protecting individuals from natural disasters, as well as commercial fisheries."
Back in 2016, United States and Canadian diplomats stationed in Havana reported hearing intensely loud noises coming from a specific direction described as humming, buzzing, grinding metal, or a piercing squeal, though a few described more low-pitched sounds. According to Business Insider, some of the same diplomats and their families later reported having trouble balancing, speaking, and hearing, with some saying they felt mentally foggy. On Tuesday, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA, a study compared brain scans from the diplomats, all of whom were stationed in Cuba at the time of the strange sounds, against scans of 48 other healthy adults who were not exposed. The findings suggested the mysterious noises may have altered the diplomats' brains in disturbing ways. The sounds that affected their brain volume, tissue, and connectivity all appear different now. According to CNN, the 40 diplomats, 23 men and 17 women, showed variations in brain structure and functional connectivity, which measures relationships among different brain regions when compared with 48 other adults. The scans were taken between August 2017 and June 2018. Ragini Verma, one of the authors of the study, told CNN there were group differences all over the brain, especially in the area called the cerebellum, which is also implicated in the kind of clinical symptoms that most of these patients were demonstrating, which is balance, eye movement, dizziness, etc. Cuba has repeatedly denied being responsible for the attacks. The BBC took a statement from the lead Cuban scientist involved in the study, Professor Mitchell Valdez Sosa. "The changes in the brain images are very small, very diverse, and very diffuse," said Professor Valdez Sosa. "I was so frustrated by the study's methodology and inconclusive results that my fellow scientists and I took the unusual step of convening a news conference. They do not correspond to a coherent explanation," he concluded. The shutdown of Havana's U.S. embassy in response to the alleged sonic attack has taken a toll on Cuba. The Miami Herald reported that since the United States withdrew all but a bare-bones staff from its embassy in Havana, no Cubans have been admitted to the United States as refugees, and the U.S. will likely fall short of its annual commitment to admit Cuban immigrants. As a result of the staff reduction, diplomats are struggling to cover significant economic and political developments in Cuba, reach out to human rights activists and members of the Cuban civil society, and monitor how the Cuban government is treating returned migrants, according to a memorandum released this week by the Congressional Research Service. An independent investigation carried out by neuroscientist R. Douglas Fields reportedly found multiple cases disproving the diplomats were attacked by a sonic weapon. Fields points out that the magnetic resonance image scans published in the JAMA study showed damage to white matter in the brains of the embassy employees. Fields wrote, "Such damage would require violent concussive forces, something I learned in my own laboratory research on blast injury and myelin." The lead author of the investigation finding white matter damage in embassy employees was identified by the Miami Herald as Michael Hoffer, a University of Miami ear, nose, and throat specialist and former U.S. Marine physician. Hoffer referred my inquiries to the University of Miami press office, which declined comment, unable even to clarify whether a manuscript showing white matter injury in the U.S. diplomats had been submitted for publication. At this point, no medical evidence of white matter damage is known to have been reported.
The World Health Organization announced last Wednesday that the current deadly Ebola outbreak in the Congo is now classified as an international health emergency. This comes after a case was confirmed in the city of Goma, eastern Congo's largest city. The region is widely described by the media and health professionals as a war zone, with individuals concerned over the lack of communication and the disjointed effort being taken by the government. Citizens of the Congo are taking necessary precautions to help mitigate the spreading of the deadly virus, but uncertainty still plagues the minds of the people. A World Health Organization expert committee did not classify the previous occasion as an outbreak, and declined to advise the UN Health Agency, even though other experts said it met requirements to be considered an outbreak. The declaration of a global health emergency often brings more international aid to help stop the outbreak from spreading, but they may also create more travel and trade restrictions that may be a crippling blow to the DRC's economy. More than 1,600 individuals have died since last August, and cases may have surpassed 2,500. The second deadliest Ebola outbreak in history, directly after Sierra Leone in 2014. According to the CDC, the Ebola virus spreads to people through direct contact with bodily fluids. This happens when infected body fluids, such as blood, make it through broken skin and through mucous membranes in the eyes, nose, or mouth. Symptoms of the virus include a high fever, severe headache, fatigue, vomiting, and unexplained hemorrhaging. Symptoms can appear anywhere between 2 to 21 days after initial contact. The case in Goma, a city situated in northeast Congo near the Rwandan border, is near an international airport. The Congolese individual traveled to Uganda and back while carrying the symptoms of the Ebola virus and later died upon his return. While health professionals are using caution and discretion handling the disease, experts indicate that the risk to outside regions is still relatively low. World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus stated that the international emergency should not be used to stigmatize or penalize the very people who are in most need of our help. Other experts say that the international response has been long overdue, but warned about the imposing of travel and trade on these countries. Global health expert Alexandra Phelan from the Georgetown University Law Center said, "This essentially serves as a call to the international community that they have to step up appropriate financial and technical support." She then added that such restrictions would actually restrict the flow of goods and healthcare workers to affected countries, so they are counterproductive. The handling of Ebola in Congo has been a point of disagreement for government officials, with the health minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo resigning this past Monday. Dr. Oli Yulunga has been heading up the response since the outbreak began last year. The resignation letter contained criticism towards unidentified actors that was pressuring the ministry to use a second vaccine supported by the World Health Organization and manufactured by Johnson & Johnson. Dr. Yulunga stated that the vaccine produced by Johnson & Johnson has not been proven effective, while the Merck treatment that has been given to over 170,000 people has been proven to be effective. The president of Congo appointed Jean-Jacques Muyembe, a head at the Congo's Biomedical Institute, to continue coordinating a government response. Thanks for listening. If you want to find more content, head over to subverse.minds.com to find articles, videos, and join our public newsroom, where you can discuss topics and ideas as well as share articles. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Medium, where we regularly post our content and receive feedback from our valued listeners, like you. Our videos and articles can now be found in podcast form on Spotify, the Apple Store, Stitcher, and Anchor. If you'd like to support our work, you can donate to our PayPal, Patreon, or Subscribestar. You can also get Subverse gear at our Teespring shop. All the links are in the description. Stay tuned for more content every day, and we'll see you next time.